Mary Powell going to the Woods Retreat, May 26, Causes and Conditions. I feel like it's become a tradition to pass a cartoon around. And so I feel obligated not that there'll be some sort of a bad luck spell if I don't keep the tradition going. So this cartoon is totally unrelated to my talk. I didn't quite have the library that Peter has. But it's about letting go, and letting go is always in season, right? This is called, it says, Psychologist's Hidden Story. And this cartoon is a true story, actually. In the first frame, a policeman is stopping a lady in a car, and it says, driver's license and registration, please. And the second frame has written over it, denial. The speed wasn't even marked. And the next one is anger. If it was, there were trees in front of it. And the next one says bargaining. I'm definitely fighting this. And it has a woman sort of imagining herself standing in front of a judge. And then the next frame says depression. I probably won't win, and then there's my time and the court fees. I'm such a loser. And then the last one is acceptance. She's driving along in her car, and she says, I just need to pay it and move on. And this is the kicker. This is the last one. It says, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's seminal work on grief came from her doing 40 in a school zone. So tonight's talk is on a Buddhist teaching called Causes and Conditions. So I want to talk about the Buddhist teachings about the conditions and the causes necessary for anything to come into being and to cease to being. I want to take a really simple example of hearing. I ring the bell, and you're aware of the sound. So you need a sound, and you need someone to hear the sound. And finally, you're aware of hearing. You're aware of the sound. So for there to be contact or knowing of the hearing, both things are really necessary. And they cannot operate independently of each other. The sound, the receiver, and the awareness, all of those must operate together. So they're a dynamic, working relationship. You can't hear the sound if there's no sound, right? And you can't hear the sound if you're too far away or if you can't hear. And finally, there is the consciousness or knowing of the sound, which can't exist without the other two, which is the sound and the receiver. Does that make sense? Everybody still with me? Sound, receiver, awareness. So let's take a really simple Buddhist formula that they use to explain this. It goes like this. In order for B to come into existence, A must exist. So in order for the hearing of the sound to come into existence, there has to be a sound. And if A, the sound, doesn't arise, then B can't arise, right? If there's no sound, there's no hearing of the sound. And when A ceases, when the sound ceases, then the hearing of the sound ceases. Sounds really simple, doesn't it? Sounds really kind of almost simplistic. But at the same time, it's really profound because this is the reality that we live in. One of the beautiful things about the Buddha that I always appreciate, it was like he always mentioned the elephant in the room, right? These simple formulas that are so obvious, things like there's suffering, there's impermanence, things that are so obvious that we don't even see them. And if all this A and B and C stuff sounds a little abstract, I'd like to take an example that's a little bit closer to home. And that is, how did you get to Vallecitos when you came here? You came in a car, right? You drove a car. Maybe your friend drove a car. You carpooled. I don't think any of you came in the van. You all came in a car. So now let's go back a couple steps and talk about the conditions that allowed you to come here in a car. You have to have a car, right? Someone had to sell you the car. Someone had to make the car. Someone had to extract the gas that you put in the car. Someone had to build the road that you drove on to get here. Doubt if you could have come down through the forest if somebody hadn't put a road in. So let's just pick any two of those, you know, like the car, the road, and let's just take it back another step, okay, for the conditions for those things to come into being. You've got the road. Somebody had to build that road. In order for somebody to build the road, someone had to pay for it. It's a Forest Service road. Someone had to go out and they had to collect taxes, which implies a complex society with a government and taxpayers and offices and et cetera, et cetera. So all those things were necessary for just the road to come into existence. And you could kind of keep going on backwards, couldn't you? All the conditions that were necessary for the car to come into existence. All the conditions that were necessary for the gas for the car to come into existence. So all these things were necessary. And that doesn't even address how here got here, right? How this lodge got here, or how this all this land got preserved, or the forces of nature and the glaciers that form this valley. So these are all the they're not all, but they're just a very, very few of the conditions that had to come into being for you to be here tonight. So if any of these things hadn't been present, you wouldn't be here. You simply would not be here. If there were not a Vallecitos, if there were not cars, if there were not a road. So I think that we could say that a certain set of conditions gives rise to a certain thing happening. So the set of conditions that we find ourselves in here at Vallecitos for this particular group of people at this particular time in this particular place all came into existence to create this and not something else. I mean, we're not a yoga retreat, right? We're not a workshop on Zumba dancing or whatever. we're sitting here together. This particular group of people and we're doing a Vipassana retreat. So we could also say that all of these conditions had to exist in relationship to each other. You know, if any one of them hadn't been there, we wouldn't be here tonight. So the practice, the retreat, the space, your car, so many other things, they had to exist in relationship to each other. And you could go, you could just keep going back and back indefinitely. And it becomes apparent that for this very moment to exist, there had to be multiple causes and conditions, and that we can't really pinpoint a single origin where it all began. Can we? Can you pinpoint a single place where all of these things began? And they all had to come together at once. So it took many, many causes and conditions coming together at once. So we could go back and we could not point to a particular starting point. And I think we could also say that we can't point to a particular end, right? This is a moment in time, but it's not the end of this whole process, is it? You'll go off and you'll have your life and you'll take something with you. Maybe you'll take a practice with you. Some of you are going camping. Maybe you, you know, you found a Dharma buddy. All kinds of things will come out of this. So we can say we can't pinpoint the beginning place and we can't really pinpoint the end place. So just looking at this one example of you coming here to Vallecitos, we could start to understand some of the attributes of this teaching, this really important teaching about causes and conditions. We could say, just to kind of review what we've talked about, we could say a certain set of causes and conditions will produce a certain thing and not something else. We could say that all of these had to exist in relationship to each other. We could also say that we could not pinpoint a place where it started and that we can't pinpoint a place where it's going to end. And finally, and I think that this is really, really the crux of this whole teaching on causes and conditions, is that there is no independent status to anything in the world. Everything is interdependent. Nothing exists independently. You're not here independently. Vallecitos is not here independently. Nothing is here that doesn't exist in relationship to everything else around it. So, maybe we're a little bit more used to the way Western philosophy looks at this, which is kind of a linear pattern of cause and effect. You know, you strike a match, it lights, you light the fire, and you have a fire. It's kind of a linear look at that. But Buddhism views things as a much, much more complex set of interrelationships. So why is this important? Is it important? Is it important? No. Yes. So, on the night of his enlightenment, the Buddha understood suffering in these terms. This is really important, that he understood it, that it came from multiple causes and conditions, and it could only cease out of multiple causes and conditions. The Buddha said that this discovery was deep, difficult, peaceful, and beyond reasoning. I tried, I was talking to a friend the other day, and she said, "What are you going to talk about?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to talk about the hindrances, and then I'm going to talk about causes and conditions. And she said, well, what do you mean? And so I went through all the A's and B's, and she said, why would I want to know all that? she was on your side. Why would I want to know all that? Well, there's a number of reasons why we would want to understand this. And one very important reason is that it starts to really erode this solid sense of self that we have, right? The sense that says, I did this. This is mine. I'm doing this. I made this. You know, you could say, well, I brought myself to Vallecetos, right? Not exactly. There had to be all kinds of other things present to bring you here. You were the catalyst. You made the intention to get here. But it isn't quite right to say, I did this. So it starts to kind of erode this sense that we have as this solid, independent self that's operating in the world. And I think another reason that it's really important to understand this is that if we want to start to make changes in ourselves, and we want to start to make changes in the world, we really need to know how things are connected and how things operate. We need to know that everything is interdependent. We can't really begin to do this work of liberating ourselves unless we know how to put the causes and conditions in place for this to happen. And you've already started doing that without realizing that. You've already started putting all of those things in place. Learning to focus your attention, learning mindfulness, learning to be with the difficult things. We're putting all of these things in place. I think another reason that this is really important is to begin to understand on a very experiential level that there is no separation between means and end. That the way that we do things and the result of that thing need to be completely in harmony. They need to be completely interconnected for the outcome of that to be what we intend it to be. Maybe you're familiar, there's a really, really beautiful phrase in the Dhammapada that goes like this. It says, hate can never end with more hate. Hate can only end with love, and with love alone. This is the eternal law. So the eternal law that they're talking about there is this eternal law that we're talking about the interdependence of everything. Hate or ill will cannot produce love. It's just not possible. Hate can never end with more hate. Very simple. In other words, the condition for love to arise is love, not hate. It's never going to work. We can't, as a world, as individuals, we can't hate ourselves to love. It just doesn't work. Or sometimes we have to have war to have peace. You know, all of these things that we sometimes hear, it just isn't going to work. Because the conditions are not in place for that to happen. Maybe some of you, did anybody see that special series on television called The Buddha's Warriors? You know, every time I give this talk, I'm the only one who saw that. I'm wondering, I'm starting to kind of wonder. Did I make that all up? I don't know. Well, it was a wonderful special. It talked about all of these, or at least I think it did, all of these different Buddhist monks who are engaged in peace processes, especially in Asia. It talked about the Burmese monks who had engaged in the protest in Burma. And one of the ones that really, really struck me was this segment on these Tibetan Buddhist monks. And they were being trained in nonviolent protest, and they were being bused weekly up to the border with Tibet, and they were being trained to engage in protest against the occupation of Tibet. And they were all living down where the Dalai Lama lives in Dharamsala, and they would go up and they would engage in these protests. And so the segment was really on this beautiful training session they had, where they were really, really questioning their motivation. They were talking a lot about what is our intention in this. Is taunting really a compassionate way to do this? How do we engage with really good, compassionate action in protest? And they were doing this for the very reasons that that I just talked about, is because they knew that they really could not achieve anything unless their intention and their motivation was wholesome. There would not be a wholesome outcome unless their intention and motivation was wholesome. That those things had to be in place. Those were the causes and conditions. Doesn't mean they're going to liberate Tibet, but there can only be a wholesome result of their action if their intentions are wholesome. And they really examine what they're doing, and they examine where their hearts are when they're doing it. I like this quote by Longfellow. It says, "If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we would find in each man's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." And I think in their hearts, they knew that. They knew that about their enemies. They knew how to have compassion for their enemies. So this teaching about causes and conditions is also extremely important, because it helps us to build confidence in the path that we're on. We know that in order for us to find happiness in our lives, we really have to put the causes and conditions in place for that to happen. It's not just going to happen because we want it to happen. We have to really intentionally, slowly, with patience, brick by brick, seed by seed, put these conditions and causes in place for happiness to flourish in our own lives. You know, it took us as human beings, it took us a long time to get in this, shall we call, pickle that we find ourselves in right now. And so we need to find ways to disentangle ourselves from some of the cultural and social habits and personal habits that have been created. And we need to start somewhere. And we can start by putting more wholesome conditions in place. You know, I think that maybe the subtext of this talk is really patience. To really have patience with ourselves. And know that these things and this endeavor that we're doing in our practice is not simple. You know, it's not something that's going to happen with one retreat. We're just beginning. We're beginning to learn mindfulness. We're beginning to learn loving kindness. We're beginning to really look at ethics. So just knowing that things take time and a lot of steady effort in our practice, it may look like nothing's happening. But in fact, we're really slowly doing much more than we think. And only greater happiness and awareness can grow out of that by this work that we're doing, even though it may not be really obvious what we're doing. I read that one of the Buddhist elders in Sri Lanka proposed a 500-year peace process for his country. Anybody who's read the history of poor Sri Lanka and what they have been through there knows that, you know, it's taken 500 years to create this kind of situation that they have there. First it was the Portuguese, and then the Dutch, and then the English, and the whole colonial mentality of divide and conquer that created all this cultural and religious strife between the Buddhist Sinhalese and the Hindu Tamil. And so he proposed a 500-year peace process. That's really a long time, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine in this country if we propose? We've only been here 200 years. This is really taking the long view of what it takes to undo things that have been created and then to put more wholesome things back in place. Hopefully our practices aren't going to take 500 years, but it's just that kind of patient view of just doing it one step at a time and doing it with real heart and real deliberation. I'm talking about sort of my media life, but did anybody see this little film? I saw it a number of years ago. It was called The Man Who Planted Trees. You saw it, uh-huh. It's a lovely little animated film, and it's about a goat herder who lived in this region of France, and I think it was sometime right after the First World War. And this region had just been severely devastated by overgrazing, and especially by grazing goats in that area. Kind of like parts of New Mexico, you know, just really, really devastated. And so everything was eroding. You know, the streams had dried up. There weren't any trees. Topsoil was gone. And so a lot of the villages in this region of France had turned into ghost towns. So the first scene comes in with this man, and he has decided that he's going to find the few remaining beech trees. I think they were beech trees in that area. And he was going to collect seeds from them. So it comes in, and he's kind of sitting there in his little hut at night with his little oil lamp going, and he's kind of separating seeds and putting the good ones over here and the medium ones over here. And then the next day it shows him kind of going out on his rounds, and he's taking his stick and he's digging holes and he's just planting seeds all over the side of these mountains. And then the next day he goes out and he waters everything. And he does this for years and years and years. He keeps doing this. And then he gets a new crop of seeds and he takes those out and he takes them around and he plants them. And pretty soon the trees start to come back. And the water starts to be held in the soil. And pretty soon the water can be infiltrated down through the roots into the ground. And it starts creating springs again. So pretty soon there's all these rivers flowing. And in the last scene, you see all these kind of people frolicking in the water, and they're all happy, and their villages are coming back to life. And this is all because one man had an intention, that he went out and he planted seeds without ever knowing the outcome. Didn't really matter. He probably didn't have a degree in environmental science. You know? He probably didn't know how the whole root system and cycle of a tree worked. He just did something with good intention. And he kept doing it over and over and over. And he changed an entire region in his country. Just by putting the causes and conditions in place so something could start to grow and to flourish. And we know this in many ways. We know it in our own bodies, right? We know, for instance, that what we call health in our bodies is really not just one single thing. It's a whole complex thing of exercise, nutrition, the bacteria in the body, and psychological health, balance, and the environment. And if any one of those is out of balance, we're out of balance. And it's really the same way in our spiritual lives, too. That we need to really have things in balance in our spiritual lives. We need to have a foundation for our practice. We need to have an ethical foundation. We need to have a mindfulness practice. We need to have a heart practice. We need to have wholesome friendships. You know, the Buddha said when he was dying, one of his attendants came up and the attendant said to him, spiritual friends are pretty, you know, they're kind of one of the most important things, aren't they? And the Buddha said, no, they are the most important thing. To have friendships and communities that support us. That's really all part of the causes and conditions for us to have a practice. It's not just one thing. It's not just sitting down in a cushion. It's creating an entire wholesome environment that's going to hold that. So just as we have all these things that hold our physical life in place, we have all these causes and conditions that really tend to hold our spiritual life in place as well. So in the same way, it's possible to start to look at our lives and see how we get caught, to see those places where we get in trouble in our lives, to see those places where there's reactivity, and to start to put some things in place that will start to counteract those things. Anything that is unwholesome in our lives, anything that's unwholesome in our minds. So in just looking at this teaching, you know, if everything really arises out of a whole complex network and interrelationship of things, then just changing one thing is going to alter the whole. Just kind of tweaking the system is really going to make a change in our life. And the Buddha talked about this a lot. You know, if you look at these endless lists that Buddhists like to put together, we can think of them as just these interminable lists that somebody memorized, but if you really look a little bit more closely at them, like, for instance, the Noble Eightfold Path, they're really a very dynamic, complex relationship of causes and conditions that hold up the entire practice. If we look, for instance, at the Noble Eightfold Path, wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. We see that without all of these working together, the whole doesn't work. And we also see that they work in a completely interrelated way. For instance, here in the West, people usually start with mindfulness practice. They start with meditation. If you were in Asia, you would probably, as Peter talked about in the Dhamma talk, you would start with generosity and with ethical practice. But when you really look at these things together, the more we practice mindfulness, the more we're aware of our ethics. The more we're aware of our ethics, the more it supports the foundation of our practice. The more we're aware of our intention, the stronger our ethics are going to be and the stronger our meditation practice is going to be. So they're all really working in a dynamic whole. The more we live in a way and do the kind of work where we don't cause harm, the more relaxed we're going to be, the more at peace we're going to be with the people around us. So often in my own practice, when I get into trouble, I'll stop and I'll say, what's weak in this system? You know, do I need to look at my intention a little bit? Is my intention really strong? Am I creating intentions for myself? How's my speech? How do I talk to people? What's my tone when I talk to them? Am I causing harm? I know there's not going to be, the minute I sit down in my practice, the minute I sit down to meditate, if I'm causing harm, the very first thing that's going to come up is that, probably as a hindrance. So they're all really working in this dynamic relationship where they're holding each other together. So every wholesome intention that we make in our lives, you know, every unkind word that we refrain from saying, every act of generosity, and each moment of being present, each moment of being mindful, can start to kind of erode some of these old patterns that we have. You know, we can look at this in a very impersonal way, in a very systemic way, that what we're putting in place, we know what it takes to create a habit, right? This constant repetition of something until it becomes unconscious. And sitting here, we start to become conscious of what our habits are, what we've created. And at the same time, simultaneously, we begin putting other things in place that are more wholesome, that will start to erode some of these unwholesome habits that we have. So I don't know of any more wholesome practice than mindfulness. You know, in every single moment of true mindfulness, there are at least 18 wholesome factors that co-arise in every single moment of true mindfulness. Just a few of them are equanimity. In order to be truly mindful, we have to be equanimous, don't we? To really be with something, we can't be pushing away the experience and we can't be grasping at anything. Generosity is another factor that co-arises with mindfulness. We have the generosity towards ourselves and towards whatever our object of meditation is. We really have to open towards it. Loving kindness, I talked about that the other night. In every single moment of mindfulness, there is simultaneously a moment of loving kindness. Mindfulness can't exist without it. We have to really welcome our experience in a very friendly way. Faith, and in Buddhism, faith is not belief. Maybe a substitute word for that would be confidence. Confidence arises. In every moment of mindfulness, we're really learning to trust our own experience. Not what somebody else told us it was about, but our own experience. Nobody, after this 6 days of sitting, I think, can tell you what your breath is supposed to feel like. You know. You know exactly what it's supposed to feel like. You know exactly what arises in your mind. You're the expert. So you're building confidence. And tranquility is one of the others that arises. Where if you've noticed the level of tranquility and calm in the meditation hall over the last few days that's been created just by being mindful. So every single moment of mindfulness brings up this whole set of wholesome causes and conditions. It's just one example. I gave two examples. One is the Noble Eightfold Path, of which mindfulness is part, and then mindfulness itself. So you can look at almost anything in the practice, and I think this is one of the really beautiful and interesting things about this particular practice is you can open the door anywhere. You know, you may find that one practice resonates with you and another one doesn't. But it doesn't really matter because wherever you open the door to practice, it's going to lead to all the others. If you open the door through mindfulness, it's going to lead to loving kindness. If you're more attracted to the heart practices and you open the door of loving kindness, it's going to lead to mindfulness. It's all going to get you there because it's all working together as a complete set of interrelated causes and conditions. So we could take this same really cosmic pattern that we're talking about here of the interrelationship of everything, and we could really look at the world in this way. We could look at it as a microcosm in our own practice, or we could look at it more as a macrocosm in the whole world. For instance, the Buddha gave a whole set of social teachings, as well as teachings about meditation. He talked about things like poverty. What are the causes and conditions that create crime in a society? And he said poverty was one. So if we're looking at the world and we're just kind of looking at the tip of the iceberg, at some of the problems in the world, we're not going to get there. We really have to look at what's underlying some of these things that we have going on in the world. So today, you know, here we are. We're faced with really huge challenges that human beings have never had before. We're faced with social challenges. We're faced with environmental challenges. But the Buddhist teachings tell us that there is a way to look at these things. And one of the things that is really important is what we're doing here. People often say, you know, why am I on retreat when I should be home saving the world? Well, we can't really save the world unless we can learn to understand what creates things. And we can start with our own minds. How causes and conditions, how mind states arise in our minds. Then we can start to understand the broader sense of how this exists in the world. So the Buddhist teachings tell us that each conscious, wholesome action that we take is going to have an effect. You know, everything that we do has an effect. Every little thing will change the whole. It'll change the whole picture. So the little things are really important, the acts of generosity, the acts of kindness, the mindfulness. So when you hear people say that they want to lead meaningful lives, how can we make a difference? How can we make a difference in ourselves, and how can we make a difference in the world? In the Buddha's teachings, everything has meaning. There's nothing that doesn't have meaning. It's all of a whole. So everything, every word, every action is interconnected. And it's interrelated, and it profoundly affects the whole, whether we see it or not. So from a Buddhist perspective, life is just completely alive with meaning in every single moment. Not just when we do something that is going to be huge and written up in the newspaper. Everything is alive with meaning. There was an East Indian teacher, and his name was, he was an East Indian and a Buddhist teacher, and his name was Munindra. And he was the teacher of many of our teachers, studied with him in India before they came back to this country. And one day, a student came to him, and the student said, "Munindraji, what is Dharma?" And his answer was really very interesting, and it was one that the student didn't expect. He simply said, "Dharma is living your life." I don't know if you remember all the way back to 5 days ago, or was there even a 5 days ago? You're so present now. But when we took the precepts and refuges, when we talked about the refuge of Dharma, I mentioned that the Dharma is only the Dharma unless it's lived. That it is a living experience. It's not something that exists in a book or on a website or even in oral tradition. And that's exactly what Munindra was saying. He said that Dharma is living your life. In other words, being fully present in a true and authentic life. So, this whole teaching, you know, I'm coming full circle here. This whole teaching on causes and conditions can only be best understood by just simply living the teachings, living a true and authentic life, and seeing if they're true for you, seeing if they bring happiness, or seeing if they bring unhappiness. So this is the only way we can know any of this, is just to simply live it. So, I just want to end with this. Some of you know Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk, and he created an order for lay people and for monastics, and he called it the Order of Interbeing. And it's really based on a lot of this idea of non-separation and interconnectedness. And this is much of what we've talked about often in the retreat, that that there is really no separation. And I'm just taking it a step further by talking about how it's all interconnected as well. And I love this because one of his precepts for this order of interbeing says, "Remember that Buddhist doctrine is not absolute truth. Truth is found in life and not in abstract teachings." So let's just sit together for a few minutes. Truth is found in life. And truly living our lives, having an authentic living experience of the Dharma in our lives. We'll have a walking period now. We ended a little early, so let's ring the bell about 8:45, whoever's the bell ringer. So we'll come back here at about 8:50.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.